Morning.
Please, the court. I'm Alan Ackerman. I represent Mr. Hendricks. The matter before the court is his criminal conviction. We have two issues we'd ask the court to address, actually three. The principal question, or one of the principal questions, relate to whether the government can make representations to the district court in an effort to urge the district court to rule in its favor by representing that a particular pivotal witness will be available, an immunized witness at that, and testify. Second question, or another question, is the sufficiency of the evidence, and I raise a mere modicum approach, which, from my research, reflects a couple of Seventh Circuit decisions, but no more. Starting with the first question, it is utterly unfair to permit the United States Attorney to tell the district court that certain evidence should be admitted, to wit, same thing, two words, captured on two or three tapes. And the essence of the government's argument was twofold. Number one, it provides context. But number two, the individual uttering the words is an immunized government informant who will testify, and the defense can go after that individual, quote, hammer and tong, close quote. The jury was told by the government attorney that Mr. G will testify to X, Y, and Z, and he will testify regarding how the May 9, 2002 matter occurred. The trial went forward. The defense made few, if any, objections to anything that might have been confrontation objectionable based on the government's representation that he would be there to testify. Now, this is not an unimmunized witness. This is somebody they could have forced to testify. So at the end of the day, just prior to resting, the government informs the court and defense, we've had enough. He may be using heroin now. We're not calling him. You're welcome to him. Now, this is in mid-trial. The defense has not the opportunity, even if they interview him, to investigate and prepare whatever it is he may divulge, if anything. So, with that, the government is already prepared to urge the court to reject a missing witness instruction. And the sequence of these events may be important to the court because moments after they announced that he will not testify, the record seems to reflect an argument about missing witness instruction. And the government was well prepared to urge the court to reject that notion in light of the fact he's an equal opportunity miscreant. So our position on that is, was it fair? Most dramatically, the answer is no. In the context of this case, you cannot promise the court, in support of making certain pretrial motions, that an immunized witness will testify. You cannot promise the jury that you will present this same witness, and then toward the end of the trial turn around and say, we learned he used heroin, we're not calling him. Okay. Now the case in chief. May 9, 2002. Incidentally, Mr. Hendricks was not arrested until August 9, 2004. So there's a 2+ year hiatus without explanation. And I suppose you could question the government about that if it's of concern to the court. But the fact of the matter is, this witness, who they wouldn't call, is the pivotal person who the government claims received 53 grams of crack cocaine on a porch during the afternoon of May 9, 2002. Now, There's lots of videotape. None of it reveals an exchange of any kind. There are people in and off that porch, as conceded by the government. But this same individual who has got pre-recorded money, under surveillance, recording devices, goes to the place he's supposed to go to make the drug deal, 623 South Campbell, goes in, leaves, goes a couple blocks, stays at his girlfriend's apartment for 20 minutes, walks back, goes back onto the porch. Now it's claimed he retrieves something, then goes back to the girlfriend's abode, stays for another 15 or 20 minutes, then leaves, and then tenders to an undercover agent the booty, a napkin, a plastic bag, and what purports to be, or what is, 53 grams of crack cocaine. Now, the government sent the napkin, the drugs, and the plastic bag to a laboratory for analysis. Nothing came back, linking it to the defendant. Those are the facts. The defendant did not testify. The jury acquitted him on a second count. So the case was close. This is not an overwhelming evidence case. And the court, I think, wisely bifurcated the verdicts. If there's a guilty verdict, then you'll decide what the quantum is. Last issue, very quickly. Our brief reflects that this same individual, the immunized informant, was not doing it for his own profit, was not doing it for himself, was not doing it to get money, but was doing it to work off the sentence of his drug supplier. And it is so much as conceded by the government that that is true. If that is true, I pointed out in my opening brief, and I repeat it, I believe, in the reply brief, that we have located two federal enactments which provide what the government can do on behalf of informants. But there is not a word about, not a syllable about allowing the FBI to utilize an immunized informant to work off his drug dealer's sentence. Now, the government, for their part, shows us two or three authorities, which I distinguish in the reply brief, and those two or three authorities, if the court please, all indicate the same thing, that the government can provide benefits to the individual who's performing the act. That, if the court please, is the appeal for the defense. We'd ask that you grant Mr. Hendricks a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ackerman. Mr. Getter.
Good morning, Chief Judge Easterbrook. May it please the court, Matthew Getter on behalf of the United States. If I may, I would like to take the appellant's arguments in order. His first argument concerned representations that the government made pre-trial to the district court as well as to the jury concerning the expected testimony of the cooperating informant, Isidore G. The government did, in fact, represent to the district court that it expected Mr. G to testify, and the government made motions in limine concerning his expected testimony. However, as we pointed out in our brief, as it turns out, Judge Zagel's rulings concerning the government's request to bring in the prior drug-dealing relationship between the defendant and Mr. G became pretty much a non-issue because the district court ruled that the whole drug-dealing relationship between Mr. G and the CI could not come into evidence with the exception of one deal that Mr. G told the government it did with the defendant just about a week prior to the transactions in question. The district court stated that the April 30th, the first phone call that was recorded between Mr. G and the defendant was inextricably part of the transaction. It's what began the negotiations for the transaction. So, of course, that phone call, which contains the words same thing, comes into evidence. The judge also gave us, as I mentioned, the opportunity to have Mr. G testify as to the deal that took place a week prior to the recordings that he made for the government. However, since Mr. G never testified, no evidence concerning the transaction that took place a week prior to the recordings came into evidence. As a result, this whole issue is moot. The representations that the government made to the district court concerning Mr. G's testimony in order to get the district court to rule a certain way in its motions in limine is irrelevant. It was irrelevant to the trial as it actually unfolded and really is irrelevant to this appeal as a result as well.
When did it become irrelevant? At what stage? Before the trial or during?
I think it would... I would argue that it became... Well, I think you have to... You look at it in two ways. First, as for the relationship, the longer-term relationship between the two, it became irrelevant before the trial since Judge Zagel excluded evidence of their relationship coming in with the exception of the one deal. Then the ruling concerning the admissibility of the one deal became irrelevant when Mr. G refused to testify because that was really the only means the government had to get that prior deal into evidence was through the testimony of the cooperator, Mr. G. Once Mr. G refused to take the stand and the government, after some efforts to get him to testify, finally declined to call him to the stand, it became irrelevant because there was no testimony concerning the prior deal.
So it's the prior deal, not the charge deal, that was no longer available and therefore he wasn't a worthwhile witness?
Well,
is that what you mean?
I'm not sure I understand the end
of
your
question.
Well,
maybe I don't understand. Apparently the deal that took place a week before, the controlled by.
Correct.
That's the one, I guess, the government intended to get into evidence through Mr. G.
Yes.
And then Mr. G, he's on drugs or something or other, he won't testify or can't or something. So the actual transaction that was charged, you didn't think that was necessary to have Mr. G?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I understand. We ultimately decided that we didn't need Mr. G to prove up the charged transaction. His testimony certainly, we believe, would have been helpful, but given the whole series of problems with Mr. G, all of which were disclosed to the defense before and during trial, made his testimony not only unnecessary, but it would have made, I believe, more of a distraction than anything else. And the government disclosed, as set forth in our brief, we disclosed to the defense not just his motivation for testifying and the benefits that he received for testifying, but also questions concerning his veracity in connection with an unrelated investigation, and then finally his heroin use.
Well, it's obvious why the defense looked forward to having him to cross-examine.
Absolutely. They were sharpening their knives.
And obviously they... It would have been very awkward to put him on as their own witness, even though his adversary, wouldn't it?
Well, that's hypothetically, Judge, if we had called him as our witness over all the problems that we had with him, if we had ended up calling him as our witness, they would have had the same opportunity to cross-examine him as they would have had to question him had they called him as a witness in their own case. Either way, the defense had an opportunity to have Mr. G come to the stand. He was equally available to both parties, whether it was through the government calling him or whether it was through defense calling him. The defense was given every opportunity to talk to him. Judge Zagel said, as in the transcript, Judge Zagel gave them the opportunity to go out to the witness room and interview him. Mr. G, as was conveyed by the government to the defense in the court, said that he was willing to talk to defense counsel, but defense counsel ultimately decided as a strategic decision that it wasn't worth it for them to call him. Perhaps they decided in their strategy, which may have been a good one, that the testimony that would have come out of Mr. G's mouth, despite the problems associated with him, would have been more harmful to the defense case than helpful. So given the fact that Mr. G was equally available to both sides, I believe the district court was well within its discretion to at least to initially say neither party can comment on his absence, and then when pressed somewhat by the defense to say, fine, if the defense comments on his absence, then the government can comment on his absence as well. that was well within the district court's discretion, and there was nothing improper about it. As far as the sufficiency of the evidence is concerned, the standard is whether a reasonable jury could have made the decision that it made. And I set forth in detail in our brief the evidence concerning the May 9th transaction of which the defendant was convicted. I'm not going to rehash it all unless Your Honor would like me to. It's set forth in the brief. There are plausible explanations for why Mr. G deviated from the plan that he had and went to his girlfriend's apartment. And there is evidence to confirm, to corroborate the fact that Mr. G did not plan to plant evidence. This wasn't a ruse on the part of Mr. G to slip around the corner to his girlfriend's place, get some drugs, and bring it to Mr. Hendricks's house. First of all, it wasn't planned that Mr. Hendricks would say, come back in 15 minutes. If this had been all part of Mr. G's plan to set up Mr. Hendricks, he would have had to guess that Mr. Hendricks would tell him to come back in 15 minutes so that he would then have the opportunity to go back to his girlfriend's place. He would then also have had to anticipate that when he came back to Mr. Hendricks's place, Mr. Hendricks would say, it's in a napkin up on the porch, and just happen to have a napkin or a paper towel with him to wrap the drugs. It's far too coincidental. So there was sufficient basis when you combine those facts with the video evidence, with the audio evidence of Mr. Hendricks saying it's in a napkin on the porch, and then the cooperator going up to the porch in the same spot where Mr. Hendricks had just been sitting and picking up an object that on video appears to be a white paper object and puts it in his pocket. There was more than sufficient evidence for the jury to reasonably conclude that Mr. Hendricks was guilty of the offense from May 9th.
I guess it is correct that he says that he, when he told him to come back in 15 minutes or something, he did go to his girlfriend's apartment. And
yes.
Then after he picked the stuff up, he went back to the girlfriend's apartment. Is that correct?
After he picked the stuff up?
Yeah.
Right, from Mr. Hendricks. Correct.
Yeah.
He went back to his girlfriend's
apartment.
And so
at each time there's a separation from the surveillance.
Yes.
But the jury heard all that argued, I presume.
Yes. The defense argued the lapse.
Could have gotten
time.
It there, could have gotten it somewhere else.
Yep. They did. And we brought it out in our closing, I can't recall actually if it was in the closing or the rebuttal case for us, but we argued the reasons why the jury should believe that Mr. G did not go to his girlfriend's apartment to get drugs that he had previously planted there to bring back to Mr. Hendricks. Finally, Judge, since I only have a few seconds left, the argument concerning the benefits provided to the CI in the form of the benefit to his friend in the form of a sentence reduction. It's clear based on the Blassingame case as well as Dawson that the government can promise immunity, benefits, security, and the like in exchange for truthful testimony, as long as those inducements are laid bare for the jury and for the defense, obviously, as well, so that they can cross-examine the person, then there's no problem with making those disclosures. It may not be seemly sometimes, the kinds of people we have to work with to prove our cases. However, as long as those, as long as all of the problems that associated with the cooperators are disclosed, it's fair game and it's appropriate for the government to use those measures. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Ackerman?
Yes, sir.
Judge Mannion, the key to what the government was talking about is what you didn't ask, I regret, and that is the whole thing about the pretrial matters and trial had to do with tapes that said, quote, same thing. So the government's theory was that in advance of May 9, there was a proceeding between the two. And there's a tape recording. And there are two words of value, same thing. That is to say, the informant is saying same thing. That is why the government promised Judge Zagel he would testify, so they could get into evidence same thing. And now, after they got it into evidence, doesn't testify. That's the whole point. They argue during summation, same thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Thank you.